Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Hello and welcome to Runners Only with Dom Harvey, brought to you by Skin Institute and Radix Nutrition. Coming up, Mills Miliaina.
How the friggin' heck I went through that. You know, when would I be able to tell my story? And I haven't really spoken about it until today. This is probably the most I've ever reflected back on anything I've done. So I thank you, Dom, for inviting me into this space and talk about myself, because it's not something I've ever done before.
I can tell.
If Mills was here right now, he would dispute this, but he is one of the greatest All Blacks of all time. He was the second All Black to make it to 100 tests, less than a month after Richie McCaw became the first. He was part of the team that won the 2011 Rugby World Cup against France in that nail-biting final. He was also part of the team that lost the World Cup 4 years earlier after being beaten by France. But Mills is so much more than a former All Black, and accordingly, rugby only makes up a small part of this epic 90-minute conversation. Genuinely, I cannot thank Mills enough for being so willing to open up about his life, especially the messy stuff. He is, by his own choice, a reasonably private person these days, so this was a rare glimpse into the mind of Mills. Just before we get into it, thanks very much to the sponsors of this episode, Radix Nutrition and Skin Institute. I've been a fan of Radix Nutrition for a long time, long before they sponsored the podcast. One of the first things I do every morning when I get up is make myself a protein shake with some of their protein powder. From their factory in the Waikato, they are making world-class nutrition products. If you currently have a daily protein shake, you should try the Radix stuff. It is the best. And they have introduced two epic new flavors to their range, mango and blueberry. Check out their amazing products online at radixnutrition.co.nz. That's R-A-D-I-X, radixnutrition.co.nz. And thanks to my friends at Skin Institute. Did you know 6,000 Kiwis are diagnosed with melanoma every year and 300 people die from it? Early detection is imperative to avoid becoming one of those statistics. Skin Institute are the skin cancer experts. Go and see them for a full body skin check. I got one about a month ago, and I feel like a mug for not doing it sooner. I was in and out in 20 minutes. Check them out online, skininstitute.co.nz, or call them 0800-SKIN-DOCTOR-DR, 0800-754-637, 0800-754-637. Okay, let's get into it. Mills Miliaina on Runners Only with Dom Harvey.
Fast pace, slow and steady, anywhere you coming. Just want to connect for everyone who loves running. Hey, Runners Only with Dom Harvey.
Runners Only with Dom Harvey, and one of my favourite All Blacks of all time, and definitely without a doubt my favourite mortgage broker of all time, Mills Miliaina. Hello.
G'day. Nice to be here, Dom.
Hey, mate, thank you so much for coming over. Thanks for coming on the podcast. I need to start by preempting something. I did. You were supposed to come on a couple of weeks ago, and then there was a last-minute family emergency, and you had to postpone. Somewhere in between then and now, I've lost my notes, and I only realised like about an hour ago, so I'm going in nude. No notes.
You thought I wasn't going to come back, eh? You were like, he's just using one of those excuses. I'll chuck these out. There's no way he's coming back.
No, I did a lot of research, but I'm not sure where it's gone. So I've got some of it committed to memory, but I actually feel okay with that because I know you're a good conversationalist, and it's great to have you here. First of all, I want to say how this came about. You were not even on my radar, and I was driving along. I think I had News Talk ZB playing, and an ad came on, voiced by you, as a mortgage broker. Yeah. And I thought, Mills would be a great guest. So I Googled you, and there you were. How did you get into being a mortgage broker?
Crazy, yep. I mean, when I sort of initially came back from finishing up playing rugby, wasn't the ideal plan. Well, it wasn't really the plan. I wanted just to come back and sort of phase out of the whole sort of rugby scene. And quietly go about owning my own business in chiropractic. And that's what I came back to study in my first year at AUT in 2017, just my prereqs. But sort of fast forward, just different things kind of happened. I've always had an interest in purchasing houses. I had a portfolio when I was playing rugby. Don't know how I got on there, but I managed to buy my first house at the age of 20. and then sort of along the way sort of built that throughout my career, and then sort of helped a number of my sort of peers into it. Came back, did a couple of shows for Sky. Scotty Stevenson sort of asked me to come on, and I was like, nah, that's media is not really where I wanted to get to. He sort of initiated that conversation while I was still playing at the Chiefs, and I was like, there's no way I want to get into that. And but I did it as a sort of a favour, went on for three shows for Sky, and it just never stopped. So fast forward, was during that time, my good mate from school, Vinnie McClifford, he's my business partner, he wanted to leave the banking space. So he's been in banking 20-odd years, managed a few banks, ASB, BNZ. And he said to me, look, would you be keen on doing it? And I was like, well, yeah, man, if you're ready, because obviously you have to take the leap and, we have to get cracking into it. Once you give your resignation and you obviously be on gardening leave, we did it. He handed in his notice and they kept him on for another 6 weeks, which was crazy. And this is where I've got to today. And so that ad that you heard, it's been a real big part because it's not something that I've been really comfortable about. Is sort of
like the public face of it. Or?
Just the marketing side of it, right. But and Jo, who's my wife, she's been pushing along with Vinny that we've got to branch out a bit more, but we've had so much success, and I suppose I'm probably a little bit comfortable in terms of sort of what we're doing and how that's came about, and it's probably how I've ended up here, mate. But if it wasn't for that, you probably wouldn't have reached out. Was never in the radar, It's a good thing.
Well, no, I appreciate it because you're such an interesting guy, and we talked just before the podcast started. One of only I think 9 or 10 people that have played like 100 All Black tests.
Yeah.
So it's good to get your story out there, and I'm pleased that you're thriving in life. Where did the money smarts come from? When did you get your first professional rugby contract? Like 17, 18?
Yeah, I was 18. I think I played New Zealand sevens at 19. I actually played for Samoa before that in the sevens part, but I played New Zealand sevens, had no idea about money. I've got 6 brothers and 1 sister. My parents broke up at an early age, while I was down there, so I never knew anything about money. We lived in social housing, rented majority of our lives. Once I got my first real contract, I kind of just spent it on anything and everything.
Can you remember how much it was?
I can't actually remember. I think it was for sevens. It was like every tournament that you went on, you got like $2,000, and then from there on, it was $1,000 if you missed the tournament. But my first sort of academy contract was $2,000. So I was at school. I came up from Invercargill, obviously, and did my last year of school at Cowston. And the following year, Auckland Rugby offered me an academy contract with $2,000. And at the same time, Southern Rugby Union offered me a $10,000 contract. And I thought, man, that's awesome. I'm going to play NPC the following year. I'm still at school. And $10,000 is massive. It's kind of like winning the lotto when you're But in the scheme of things, it wasn't that much money at all. I mean, I would have blown – some of my contracts probably would have blown that in 2 weeks, and given the partying I used to get up to.
But I suppose when you're that age, all you can think is, like, I can get a car.
Yep. Cha-ching, buy mum a house, $10,000. I wouldn't have even been able to afford anything, really. Yeah. So, 18, 19-ish, I had a relatively sort of semi-pro contract. And then it's just funny looking back now because I feel so old because some of that stuff I can't even remember. It's just
how old are you now?
I'll be 43 in July, right. So I'm 42.
Looking good.
Yeah, trying to. It's always harder these days. But it's crazy looking back at how fast sort of things evolved, and then playing professional rugby. I often just wonder how I ended up doing it because it was just kind of.
What do you mean?
I think when you're kind of in it and things happen and the pressures of the world and the pressures of playing rugby, you don't realise how fast time flies until you get to the end of your sort of not the end of your career, but the end of your the life cycle here in New Zealand, right? You kind of think far out. I'm not even that old. I'm, 30 years old, and I'm kind of like, man, there's still a whole lifetime ahead. And that's probably when I started thinking about what life after rugby. And the big priority, what was it? Big thing for me, I shouldn't say a priority, was that I didn't really want to be living in the whole bubble anymore. Like, I'd had enough of that. I had enough of, being walking down the show. I was happy to be able to
be anonymous.
Of, Yeah, and just really? Do my own thing and just sort of – and that's probably part of the reason why I wasn't big on advertising and marketing because, you know, I felt that, you know, I could, you know, easily just sort of do my own thing and be happy with that as long as I knew what I was kind of getting up to and doing.
No sort of desire or ego to be in the public eye, really.
No, which is crazy now.
It is because, I mean, you've got such a remarkable career and everyone loves you. You know, it would be understandable and it would make sense to, like, cash in on that great name that you've built.
Yeah, I just...
Look, it's not your thing.
It wasn't my thing. I think
You're just exhausted from it being your thing for so many years.
I didn't really want to be... It wasn't a thing where I thought, man, I still want that. I still want that identity.
Yeah.
Having people sort of know who I was...
come on, everyone's always going
to
know.
Well, and what you did, you know, almost to the fact where they go, oh, you know, I've seen that guy somewhere. Was it an ad or was it a TV show? No, I was happy with that, you know, rather than sort of like you have been with the rugby days where everything's about rugby and what you've done on the field and more in particular sort of off the field too. So, But it's just, I love it. I love what I'm doing now. You know, I loving the work that I do. I'm loving being in a broadcaster, if that's what you want to call it. Really enjoying that side of life and sort of the opportunities that have, I suppose, come from the stuff that I didn't really want, which has been fantastic.
Yeah, it's kind of cool because so you had a definite plan of what you wanted to do, and then this other stuff just sort of popped up, and you were able to pivot, which I think is really cool. Like, it's important to have a plan rather than just to, like, you know, bob along hoping something's going to come up. But it's like everything's worked out good for you.
Yeah, 100%. I think and often guys fall into that trap.
Yeah,
you know, they. I mean, you're only young. I mean, I mentioned 30, 31, and before you know it, you're out in the big world, and it is actually the big world. You're kind of like, you know, scrambling to trying to, you know, the last thing you want to be doing is scrambling, trying to find your feet and understand who you are and what you want to do. Hence the reason I knew, you know, I wasn't going to be on the same pay packet, but I put some aside to know that, okay, well, here's what the next four years may look like. But still had that sort of vulnerability to say, well, in 4 years' time, that business might not be what it is.
Yeah.
Because in some ways, I know it sounds weird, but I still have that in me, like that whole feeling of vulnerability and being like, I mean, it's almost like a goal. I've got to get to that. Oh, no, we're not quite getting there. It's the same thing with business, not meeting your targets or the staff aren't doing what you're asking them to do or things like that. So a lot of the rugby skills that I've learnt has transitioned into this real, you know, the real life and the real world and what that sort of looks like, and it's been amazing. In fact, I'd say I've learnt a lot from rugby that people in the business sense probably haven't quite learnt yet. Which, I mean, I'm really grateful about.
Can I just say, like, I'm blown away. We're 10 minutes into this chat. I always remember you through your playing career when I'd come to, like, your press conferences and things at the Heritage Hotel, or you'd come into our radio show. You were always, like, articulate and well-spoken, but you were kind of shy.
Yeah.
Now you're so chatty. Oh. Is that just through maturity?
Definitely. I've matured so much from the guy that was pretty reserved. I just answered the questions sort of... I suppose
cliches,
and you kind of think, "Far, if I had my time, I'd love to do that all over again." You know, being where I am now, because you often get caught in the fact that you are in such a bubble, being, you know, an All Black, and you don't want to say the wrong things because it might get taken out of context, which it does. But I think being exposed to that now, I'd be exposed to public speaking and being exposed to being on TV, it's definitely helped your confidence. It's not. It's crazy because you don't learn that stuff. It's not something you can go, man, I'm going to – well, you can go to broadcasting school, but I've had to learn along the way, and that's really built my confidence and also understanding, okay, well, I've got to be good at the stuff that I'm providing. If that's financial advice, you know, when you're a qualified financial advisor, you've got to be comfortable that you know and understand that. Same with rugby. If I don't understand what I'm doing or the team stuff that I'm doing, I'm not going to be able to do my part for the team or my part for my clients if I'm sort of not doing my homework or not doing my analysis, as they would call it. But it's definitely I'm a lot more chattier than I used to be.
Yeah, I'm noticing that already. It's really cool.
Yeah.
It's cool. I like it. I like it. Good for you.
Yeah.
So let's go right back to the beginning. So where were you born?
So I was born in Samoa.
Samoa, yeah. And you moved to... Why the fuck did you move to Southland?
It's crazy. Like I know. Yeah. Everyone always asks me that. And like, to be honest, when I first came up, they were like, man, some of them, obviously I've got a lot of, went to Kelston Boys and a lot of Polynesians out there. They used to think I spoke funny. It wasn't until I realised later what they were sort of talking about. Even people now saying, you know, I'm trying to speak like a European, but it's absolutely the way I've been brought up. My parents came over on a ballot when I was 3 years old. There was only myself and my two other siblings at the time. And obviously you got to get sponsored. Work was needed. You needed, occupation. Mum's family were down in Invercargill. They're in the forestry. Freezing works was massive. Obviously the oysters. So that was where we ended up, and a bit of support around obviously Mum's family being down there. And they never left. I mean, Mum's still down there. My majority of my siblings love it down there. We go down there all the time because my kids are similar ages to my brother's kids. So it's a wonderful place, but it also has its challenges, and that was part of the reason why I ended up leaving.
what challenges? Like are you talking climate-wise?
That was, but...
crossing the road because the roads are so wide?
So wide, aren't they? We only just came back on the weekend, over on Friday, and Raji, who works for us, he's like, man, these roads are so wide, you put two motorways on there.
Yeah.
But I think I just got too big for my own shoes. I think, I was obviously, pretty good at rugby. Came through the grades, and then when my parents split up, Mum was a solo mother. Probably didn't get a real big handle on, I suppose, us
how
as kids.
How old were you? How old were you when they broke up?
Nine.
Nine.
And then I suppose just going to parties and sneaking out and getting myself into trouble. I ended up fighting a lot. I don't know why, because I'm not a fighter at all. I'm the guy in the back that sort of waits for everyone else to fight.
What was it? Was it just like booze, or was it just like teenage rage? Or?
Yeah, I think just your teenage stuff, going out and partying, first 15 parties, and then ending up in McDonald's at the end of the night, and and then just stuff starting and then getting amongst it. So I got I went to court for assault and got discharged without conviction.
Did you? Like when you were still at school?
I was still at school. Yeah. So I was in sixth form. And that was probably the big turning point for me, because I went from that, I was in sixth form. I always remember being picked up from an RDO, because I was going to court and the police turned up at home. Took me in, obviously, after the weekend, and Mum had no idea. So I still remember this day having to explain to her what was kind of happening, going to court, getting community service for it, but it was an eye-opener. Mm. I made the South and Sevens, the men's squad, at that time. And then basically, I got myself together. I still had that sort of part in me because I was so young and
yeah.
Getting to that age and your mother not being able to sort of really control sort of teenage boys. And then it wasn't until I made a New Zealand touch team, and I came up in January in 1998. And my brother had come up the year before to go to Kelston Boys. He really loved it, and he thought I should come up to get away from things. And I decided I was going to.
Oh, yeah, there's way less trouble in Auckland.
Yeah, way less, I know. There's way bigger boys up here too, mate, so I wouldn't have been able to be confident.
True.
Came up, the family friend that I was staying with met the Solomons. I planned on actually coming up in January, then going back home and then pleading to my mother not to let me go.
Yeah.
But he said, you're not going home. And it was just kind of like, holy shit. I was just – I probably cried in my room every day before school, because I was just going to the school. I didn't know about it. In fact, before school even started, I had to finish off my community service hours at Kelston, which is where I met my business partner. I mean, obviously, it was mates with my big brother, but I was cleaning windows, taking the rubbish out, helping mow the first 15 field, number one pitch. But I was really scared. I didn't know what I was. What I was getting into, I'd sort of left the comforts of being with my mates and that. And that's where everything else flamed into it. And hence the reason why that $10,000 that Southern offered me at the end of that year was so important, because I was thinking, man, I hated it up here. So hated it. I wanted to go home. I've got $10,000 now that I've been offered. Auckland only offered me $2,000. I was like, man, it doesn't, you know, it's an obvious choice of where to go. But again, I had to have hard conversations again with my mum and also my brother about where I'd end up. And I chose Auckland with a push from them. And I never looked back. It was just crazy. And it's kind of been that in my whole kind of, I suppose, career. I've always sort of fallen off the wagon a little bit, or well, I'm going to say wagon, fallen off the path, jumped myself back on, fallen off again, had faced adversity, been real strong about that, and then also sort of come back and just, so whilst it's sort of fallen into place, there's been a lot of hard stuff that's happened along the way, which has, I suppose, made me who I am today.
Yeah, you have been through some stuff. I mean, we can get into this later on as much or as little as you want to, but so you're in Auckland, you got the $2,000. You go to a school like Kelston, there's a lot of good rugby players there, right?
Yeah, man.
So were you just like naturally good? Were you bigger than most? No, you weren't bigger than most.
I wasn't big at all, no. Man. I still remember my first game and I was thinking, some of these guys have got beards. Like, you know, you're looking over and you're thinking, there's no way. I know, man. I'm like, far out, man. How am I going to survive this? I was fortunate enough I had a bit of speed. So I think that really helped. I was on the wing. So I got myself used to it. We had a dominant team. Like, our team was so good. And then I think all but two guys from our team became professional rugby players.
Wow. Who were some of your teammates that went on to
Semi Tuitupo, it is Mose Tuili'i. Who else was there that would
Shit, it's a stacked team.
There's a lot of, there was a lot, man. I can't remember off the top of my head now. But still guys that I still get onto. I mean, they play professional rugby in some way, you know, whether it's NPC or overseas as well. So yeah, we had a really talented team, and I kind of just fell into that and just found my groove, really. Made New Zealand schools, and then under-19s and 21s and sort of came through. And those were the teams that I wasn't really making from South Island, because I suppose I wasn't really exposed to the big boys. We'd come up and we'd play them. You were like, shit, these guys are big. And that was probably half the reason why you'd lost. You lost before you even got onto the pitch, right?
Yeah, like the mental battle.
That's it.
Just intimidation.
That's it. Yeah. Man, there's no one want to tackle these guys. So that was the majority of the battle, really. Whereas things now, they're so similar now, which is, helps a lot of guys. So,
yeah. And when did you first make the All Blacks? Who was your coach back then? Was it
It was John Mitchell and Robbie Deans.
Right. So, did your career overlap with Christian Cullen?
No.
No.
So everyone thinks that I played against him. And I often get tagged on the guy that sort of took over from Cully, but I wasn't. I pure luck. It was Leon McDonald, really, and he came injured. In fact, I was one that injured him. I sort of slid across and kneed him in the head and got him concussed. And one of the, I think it might have been the final or one of the games during the Super 2003 Super Rugby Championship. And then obviously they tried Dougie there the first game that we lost against England, and then I got my shot and I played 31 games in a row, and it was kind of like, fuck, this is crazy. So I kind of got my opportunity off that, but often I get tagged with a guy that sort of took Cully's spot, when in actual fact it was not me at all.
Yeah, so John Mitchell, so he's your first coach. And then it was early in your All Black career. I'd forgotten all about this, and I think most people would have. So we don't even have to go there if you want, but you got in some trouble early on. Like, there was you got in a fight somewhere, and then like public urination. So this is before social media.
Yep.
I'm guessing there was like MySpace or Bebo.
Yeah, yeah.
But no sort of camera phones. So how did that happen? Was it a big deal at the time? I'd forgotten all about it.
Man, it's crazy, eh? Because, again, when I mentioned the fact that there's been some challenges along the way, but that's just, you know, I look back at an incident and, you know, while, you know, discharged without conviction, that's still party life from Invercargill, where you sort of, you know, pitch in together and have, you know, 10 or 20 bucks each and go and buy a keg and just get absolutely mothered, was still kind of in me, even though I didn't have 10 or 20 bucks. you know, I'd often just like try and scrounge off my mates.
Yeah. I'm a little bit older than you, but yeah, the keg party thing. Mates chipping in every Friday.
If 5 years, man, I think it was $100 or $90 or something. Yeah. You get a keg and you just sit there and just get absolutely trolleyed. Mm. You know what I mean, that was.
It was the mentality, eh?
It was.
Sit in the garage.
It was. And part of that was still in me, but now I've got a whole heap of money.
now it's like it's Central Otago red wine.
Not even that, but it's all free, you know, because, you walk in after an after match, it's all put on there. There's a bar that's allocated. You walk in, the sponsors' products are all there. There's a bar tab on. So, before you know it, you're not even spending your own money, but you're just getting mothered too. So here I was now coming from a life like that and still a huge part of me. I was partying every weekend. And then when I said about my money, that was going too, even though things were free. I got back from the Commonwealth Games. I was just after my 21st birthday, highly intoxicated. And it's, you know what's crazy about this, Dom, is I was sitting in the barbers and no word of a lie. And my wife was in there and I was getting my haircuts with the kids. And the guy was sitting there and goes, oh, g'day. And those guys, it would have been about a couple of months ago now. And usually every now and then I go, oh, yeah, just pretend I know who it is. And he's like, oh, yeah. And then he mentioned, hey, do you remember me? My wife wasn't even around then. And I said, oh, who are you? And he was like, oh, I'm the guy that helped you out of the bar when you pissed in it. And I was like, mate, I'm 40-odd, 20-odd years ago. And there's a guy here that's just like, he's the guy that sort of kicked me out. I don't know.
I said, did you piss in the bar?
Yeah, I pissed at the bar. But when I look back and I remember, I got a call from the manager and I was like, fuck, okay. So when I was a nobody then, really, I was like, so I was thinking, okay, man, there's no way this is going to come out. You know, hopefully I might have dodged a bullet. Bought the NZ Herald and obviously it's folded in half and I was looking at it's not there, going through or not. I was like, shit, I've missed it. And then as I've closed it and then flipped it over, it's on the front page and here's my face.
Oh, so you went straight to the sports page.
I was thinking, shit. And, mate, it was massive because I sort of got to the part where I'm kind of like, hey, I'm like, one, I was more embarrassed and for my family and especially my mother. This was now going to be, and mum's, she's got a massive support network down there in terms of the church and the Methodist church and all the old ladies that have been talking to her about it. And so it was more kind of that. Yeah. I was still really young. I was still 20. I probably that hurt really bad. And I think I was like thinking far out,
just the guilt and shame of letting your family, and letting yourself
more than anything else, you know, because I still in my mind, I was like, oh, this thing is 21-ish. And I was like, okay, cool. I've got to give up alcohol. And actually put some processes. And well, I hate to use the word process, but put some things in place so that I don't get mothered, or don't get to that sort of stage, which is.
Did you reach that decision yourself, or were you sort of down with a leadership group?
Nah, there wasn't really a leadership group then. As well, there's sort of leaders, but I was still relatively pretty young, and I just thought, man, I don't want to do this again. I was more around the driven about not
putting your family down.
Yeah, more than anything else. And then, I met Leo Malloy, maybe similar time to when this is crazy, and I think he actually owned the bar. He said to me, "Oh, he didn't even." He said that he'd owned the bar then many years ago, and that was sort of how he remembered me. I was like, "Okay, that's a nice way to be remembered, eh?" But it's crazy, and I suppose I started putting things into place, the goals that I really wanted to achieve from that, and part of that didn't involve alcohol. It gave me a sense to actually. Have something to strive for and be successful on the field and I think for the very first time, that was probably the very first time I actually backed myself and thought, man, I'm actually a good player because one, I'm on the front page, but I didn't think I would be. And two, I wanted to show people that I was a good rugby player.
Yeah.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
I think like what you did beyond that, I mean, you know, come on, 100 tests. It feels like you set a plan or you set some goals and you fucking smashed them, mate.
Yeah, I did.
You did really well, and it was like a flawless career.
Yeah, and as I said, I mean, a lot was that was driven by the things that you relate to now, just having goals, don't go out at night. You know, I mean, the altercation when I got, you know, after the final. And just getting, you know, dragged out of a taxi from that and then having a broken eye socket.
Well, yeah, so what was that one?
That was 2020. That was 2003. So
2003 after years, so after what final? The like, Super Rugby.
Super Rugby final. Oh, yeah. And so
what happened?
Oh, we're down at the Spy Bar or whatever it was, and I was in a, well, obviously getting had a little bit of tongue in cheek to some of them, and one of our teammates got kicked out, so I followed him out, and I sort of got tongue in cheek at the same time, highly intoxicated, jumped in the cab, and I got dragged out of the tag, and it was just dealt to, really. But it was funny because it was just, well, not funny, but it was just crazy because I've gone throughout this whole period of goals and everything, and I've got to that point where I'm like just pissed in the bar the year before. I want to get myself, make sure that I get off the piss and really focus on rugby, which I did. Won the final that following year, had been on it, and the first time that I did it, this way happens, it wasn't even my fucking fault.
Yeah.
And then the next day, the All Blacks team was going to be named. Oh. And this is why it was crazy, because yeah, I had such a good season, and I didn't really think I was going to be named. And every time I get asked, I know, where were you? Where were you when you got, you know, named in the All Blacks? I honestly thought that they weren't going to pick me because...
Why did you think that?
Well, urinated in a bar. Get stuck into this. You know, they all said, where were you? Where were you? Well, to be honest, I was, you know, at home with an ice pack over my broken eye socket waiting for my name to be read out. So it was just an awesome memory. Yeah. It's still one that often like sort of...
Mixed emotions.
Exactly. But it was, man, loved the fact that Mitch and Robbie sort of had faith in picking me, even though, you know, they had the understanding of what obviously happened. But it almost took that one moment to not even be selected as an All Black. And I don't know I'd still get back onto the path and be more motivated to do anything else. But I still sort of really grateful and thankful that it didn't eventuate to that, because I wouldn't be where I am, obviously, today.
Yeah, I feel like it'd be very different now. Like, I feel like there's way less tolerance now, like, no sort of second chances. So the eye socket thing, is that the line in the sand where you're like, right, that's it, I'm not fucking up again?
Well, I didn't want to – it was a Rugby World Cup year. Yeah. I've loved – man, it's almost like I just – when I got that opportunity that I mentioned before about after they tested Dougie at fullback, I was like, fuck, I just absolutely loved it. I didn't really want to – you know, they say in the All Blacks, so hard to be not selected, to get into it, then obviously be dropped. But it was everything I'd ever dreamed of. I never thought that that's what it felt like, to constantly be picked every week, go out there and play, and I really enjoyed my rugby. It wasn't so much, okay, all these things that had happened, you know, I don't want to go down there again. I just loved being an All Black. Absolutely loved the fact. And admittedly, I didn't think I'd ever would become an All Black. It's probably on the back end of that, but I just...
Why not?
When you're a
Samoan kid from Southland
every other... It's, you just aspire to these heroes that you see on TV, and, you know, Michael Jones of the world, and Joelle Vendiri, the Ronnie Clarks, they're all in Auckland, and you don't really get to touch them, really. And to then play with them in the Auckland sides and then become this All Black, you're just thinking... You pinch yourself because you've kind of like, this wasn't supposed to happen. You know, it was literally a dream to be an All Black, but you're in it. You love it so much. I didn't I didn't want it to end.
Yeah, well, and you did pretty well too.
Yeah,
yeah. Yeah, I hung on for a bloody years. Long time.
Yeah, I did. I literally did hang on to right down to the very last moment, which is why I ended up going to a chiropractor and getting him to fix me up.
Yeah. So who was in your early? Did your career overlap with Jonah?
Was
he done by?
No, I played sevens with the big man. I played against him. I remember sort of marking him a couple of times when I played wing for Auckland and also for the Blues. So,
were you and Jonah quite tight? You were sitting next to him at Jerry Collins' funeral.
So when I played sevens in 2000, the first sevens in Wellington, that's when I really got to meet Jonah for the first time. Man, it was crazy because it was kind of like...
Did he buy you a car? Apparently he met people and bought them cars.
He didn't buy us a car, but I often told this story about... Because, when you're in Titch's environment, you can't touch any of the fatty foods and stuff like that. Just finished the first day of the tournament. Jonah was like to me and Marcio Valance, "Oh, let's go, man. We'll go for a ride, go for a feed." And we're like, "Oh, yeah, sweet." And he goes, "We're going to KFC." We're like, "Oh, we weren't going to say no, right?" And man, it hit us big because we lost the final the next day against Fiji. But you weren't going to say no. And I literally would put it down to the fact that he took us to KFC and ate the fatty foods. Don't get me wrong, I love KFC, but
who doesn't?
Yeah, but I'll put it down to that. But who would say no to Jonah when he's offering to take you to KFC in that big boom box of a car?
That's right. He had the world record for the loudest car.
Such a cool car, man.
Crazy guy. Eh? I'm so gutted that he passed away because he'd be just the ultimate podcast guest. Yeah. I'm quite good friends with Kelly and their careers overlapped quite a lot. And they'd go to a new town or they'd go to like a Selectric store and he'd buy like a boom box for the bus. Yeah. Apparently he was just like insanely generous. So when he passed away and you found out that he wasn't financially secure, like it makes perfect sense. He blew a lot of money.
He did. And sad too. And I suppose being who he was, he's very, very generous. Down to earth, sort of spoke at your level, even though he wasn't. He was way above it in terms of the stardom and who he was, but also financially. And it's often that's the sort of stuff we kind of see now with some of the guys, particularly the Māori and Pacific Island boys, which I've been really big on. And the financial space is making them understand something, not just your money, but sort of how it all works, why you've got a mortgage and the mortgages and what it looks like, what interest rates are, how you get into, because one day it's going to finish. And
only guarantee, isn't it?
Yeah, no one's going to be there to tell you, to actually say, well, this is what it is. You need to refix your mortgage and to why. I mean, some guys have even rang up and said they want to go to an auction and they're like, well, have you got a pre-approval? And they're like, oh, what's that? So it's crazy.
Where did your literacy come from? You mentioned you were telling some of the other guys about buying houses and you had a house by the time you were 20 or something.
Yeah, I kind of just jumped in and did it and then sort of asked questions. Whilst I was a little bit quiet, I sort of understood what that kind of looked like. It helps when you've got mates that are in that sort of space to bounce, questions off as well. But once you understand what the banks are looking for and the jargon that they're talking, that's often the case. They're just talking a whole heap of jargon. When you strip it back, it's really, really simple, but sort of explaining it in a simplistic way.
Yeah.
I've had to read up a lot on sort of how, but it's also experience and stuffing things up, not quite doing your own stuff properly, have led to that, but also listening. I think we've got a really good team, man. We just bounce sort of stuff off because often that's where you learn the most from someone else's mistakes when they've opportunity or something that's unfortunately they haven't quite got right. And so it's just more around that, just the experience around that and a lot of reading.
What's the coolest thing you've done with your money? Did you manage to buy your parents a house or anything? Or
I have.
Really? Cool.
So yeah, I did that in 2007. $188,000 it cost me.
That's a mansion in Invercargill.
It was a lot of money at the time when I was thinking to myself, I'd already just purchased my house for $250,000 out west in New Lynn. So that time it was crazy. So it's probably the best thing I've done.
Yeah. Yep. That's really cool. So it was you bought her a house outright, or did you pay off her mortgage? Or
no, I got to a stage where I started using money a bit better. So using the bank's money to buy other things, using equity in it and going. But it's a really high end thing to be able to understand, because you can do it that way. Often you hear people, or my brothers and that, say, "Man, now debt's, I hate debt, got to pay it off, got to pay it off. Mm. As soon as I've paid it off, then what?" But actually,
it's good debt and bad debt.
There is, yeah. So you're using actually good debt to baddie to get you to another place. And in the end, the safety is, as long as you don't lose your job, you know, that you can always sell one off to pay for another one.
Yeah.
So that's kind of how I've sort of geared things up and generated sort of that portfolio. But again, it's just about learning sort of how that works. And you often get people asking about equity and saying, "Oh, well, I've got this much equity, but you've got to understand how the banks use equity.
Yeah.
And that's probably the things that we like to explain. I love explaining that stuff because you can use I often use my own situation because I relate to it better, and I can explain it better because I've been through it. So that experience is massive and
invaluable.
I love drawing on that.
Yeah, God, you found a real passion, eh? Like I can see your eyes light up when you talk about like the money and the nuances of the finance markets. So did you surprise your mum with the house, or was she expecting it? Or
they actually lived in Aussie, so I was always something that I wanted to do, and then they moved back, and so it was a little bit of a surprise, but always something I suppose I've spoken to her about buying them a place, which is, she lived in there for years until last year, and then sort of moved out. Now my brother lives in it. But mum's always appreciative of that. They probably can do their own house. They actually moved into another house because I bought it and they've lived in it. I've got my other brother renting it. But not good advice to have a family living in your own property. Yeah. It doesn't get you much yield at all.
Yeah, well, I'm lucky enough. I've managed to buy my mum an apartment. So she lives in Grey Lynn, and it's still in my name. I'm guessing your mum's. Yep. But I was sort of thinking, it's a good retirement thing, and you know, mum can live rent free. It's costing me a bit of money now, but you know, whatever. But it occurred to me that we went overseas recently, me and mum, and so I'm 50, she's 71. She's still going to be alive at 90, so I'm going to be like well and truly retired by the time she carks it. So I can't rely on that.
Oh, you will be, mate. By that time, hopefully the house markets would have just, well, they are. They're crazy at the moment. They've gone ballistic. They might have doubled by the time she's 90, right?
Yeah.
So you might be okay, and hopefully you won't have too much debt. You can probably live off it.
Yeah, no, it's all good. Okay, so how many World Cups did you do?
I did three.
Three. So were you in the one where we got beaten by France? And what year was that? Was that
2007.
2007.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was awful.
That sucked.
So that was the quarterfinal.
Yeah. So
and they just everything went lucky for them.
Yeah. Well, not lucky. We just
played, no, like bounce of the balls.
Oh man, we pieced so bad. I've never watched that final, that quarterfinal. I just haven't got it in me to watch it. It still hurts like a lot, mainly because you were like, "Fire! I've still got to go home. I've got to go back to New Zealand." And then they had the old, "Okay, well, we didn't have flights. Here's the first group that I'll go and go, please don't read my name out. Please don't read my name out." And I was lucky I was on the second list because I was going, "Oh, good luck, guys. You guys are going to get hammered when you get home from the public." But it was a crazy time. We've often talked about it a lot, about the things that we didn't quite right. But I think a lot of the stuff that we didn't get quite right, we got it right in 2011.
This is the thing I've discovered in life. Like your failure is actually not a bad thing. You learn nothing from your wins, but you learn everything from your fails.
100%. And my life has been like that. It's been like I've failed so many times, but as long as you get back up, that's been my biggest driver. Like, man, you can be in it, and man, it's so tough. A lot of the stuff that you have gone through, and even my wife talks about it. I don't know, so thick skinned, but you kind of get to a level of tolerance where you can, you know, be thick-skinned about the mistakes that you've made, and that, you know, obviously being in the public eye, it comes, you know, 100 times more because you're in New Zealand in a small country of 5 million, but everyone knows who you are and what sort of happened. So you have to come a bit more resilient in terms of those mistakes that you do make. But, man, I'm a big believer in you've got to learn from that. You know, I often look at it now and see, you know, especially when you're playing, guys that are playing now, whether I sort of, I suppose, judge them on can you bounce back rather than, you know, not being able to bounce back for something, for a mistake that you might have made off the field. Because, you know, guys and people do that, I've got so much more respect for them because it's a hard damn thing to do. It's so easy to sort of curl up and say, oh, nah, it's sweet, I'm a failure. You're not. Those failures are real massive in terms of the growth in yourself and your personal growth and whether you can come back from those.
Yeah, I agree. Have you always been resilient, or do you think the shit you've been through over the years has made you? There's that saying, what doesn't kill you makes you stronger.
Yeah, I know, man. It's crazy. It probably has. Admittedly, I would have loved to not have so many fuck-ups. But it has. It really has. And I think if you draw back at the stuff, you know, my mum's is big, and I've always sort of – that's been my biggest driver. Mm. You know, when I've sort of fallen off, it's like, oh, shit. It's not so much about me as sort of how do I make it right. So, you know, when you're turning up at home and mum's sitting there with a smiley face telling you how much she loves you, you're like, oh, fucking hell. Deep down inside, I know you're really hurting. But that's been, I suppose, my biggest driver to try and get back on and succeed.
Yeah. Mm. By the way, you talk about fuck-ups like there's been heaps of them. There hasn't, though. There hasn't, though. Like, from an outsider's perspective, at least, it seems like it's been it's a heck of a career. Like, we all know that. But it feels like the... like indiscretions, mistakes, call them whatever you want. Really, I know when you like the urinating in a bar and the eye socket thing. Like at the time, it probably feels like it's your entire world. But then you look in the rear view, like 20 years on now, whatever it is, it sort of feels like nothing, right?
Yeah, mate, it does. It's still a part of me that goes fucking. It does. I mean, it's always stuff that I've got to get better at, and it's probably the alcohol. You know, there was, and a lot of my stuff's always been public as well. There's the latest one in Cardiff in terms of the sexual assault stuff. I mean, that was again fucking after midnight.
Since you've brought that up, let's talk about that because I really felt for you through this whole thing. So I woke up on a Sunday morning here in New Zealand. Took my phone off flight mode, and the first pop-up I got was like Staff or NZ Herald, and Mills arrested, and then there's footage on TV. So you're playing a game there?
Yep.
What club? What team?
So I was playing for Connacht in Ireland.
Right.
And we just played the Cardiff Blues. We were out that night. It was like it's crazy, and this is just crazy how things panned out. Would have been just your normal sort of night out, albeit, you know, you're again intoxicated and getting back. And it wasn't until about a month later that we went back to play, we went back to actually Gloucester to play them. And that's when I got picked up. I just injured myself and I was walking off the field and I walked off after the end of the game, and then these police through there, and I was like, oh, okay, sweet. I thought,
yeah, so you'd like your boots on.
I had my boots off.
Playing gear and
I was limping. I was limping off, and I was just kind of like fucking got off. And I just thought it was a practical joke. I thought, here's these cops, and they go, no, you need to sit down. And I was like, I sat down just outside the change room. And then I'm like, I couldn't even actually grab anything. They said, you need to come with us. And I was like, I still thought they were bullshitting me. And then it wasn't until they said, we're going to take down to the station. I was like, okay, sweet. I might just grab a jacket. So our baggage man grabbed me a jacket. I went outside, and as soon as I got outside, the cameras were there, like just waiting.
Yeah.
And I think when I look back at it, that was probably the most guttering part. I had no idea.
Were you angry or just sad or confused?
I had no idea what the heck was going on. I had no idea, even when, so we went down and they took me to the police station. I think later on I was really angry because, one, the club knew it was happening.
Yeah.
And two, So did the rest of the broadcasting team.
Decided
to know, and I had no idea what the heck was going on. Furthermore, man, my leg was aching so bad it wasn't funny, mate. But I went down. They processed me. They had to take me from Gloucester to Cardiff. Still had no idea. I had absolutely no idea what was going on. I was in the back of the paddy wagon.
So you're running through your mind, what could I have done?
Yeah, what's going on? They didn't really say anything. I got there. This is during the 2015 Rugby World Cup. I got there and went and started doing the paperwork. They might have mentioned it then. I can't remember now, but they were really friendly talking to me about the Rugby World Cup and stuff like that. And I was just in a different world. I was just kind of like, what the heck's going on? They gave me this book to read about rights and stuff. Then they put me in a cell. And I was like, so it would have been about close to midnight. I'd just come. Well, no, it was at like 9:30 finish game. It took me to the Gloucester police station, done all the stuff there, put me in a paddy wagon. By the time I got to Cardiff, it was midnight, put me in a cell and then left me there. Basically left me there. They gave me, let me have a shower and put my rugby gear back on. Left me there. And no one came until about 4 o'clock the next afternoon the next day.
Oh my god.
So I was just sitting there going, I didn't know what was going on. No contact with anyone else other than, I don't even think, perhaps they made me a sandwich. And then I got, then the lawyer, someone got a hold of a lawyer for me, and that was it. That was all I kind of heard. Wasn't allowed to talk about it.
What do they tell you? What do they tell you you're being charged with?
Sexual assault. That was it.
But no further details?
No, nothing further, actually. And then he came in with me. We went into this was about 3 o'clock. We went into one of those interviewing rooms, and they asked me to watch a video. And I was kind of like, okay, I'm watching a video. I didn't see Jack. I couldn't even tell you what I seen in the video. But all it was a female had sort of backed into me, and I turned around and just sort of gave her a push. And you couldn't even see that side of it. I mean, I made out that I'd given her a sort of a but all you seen was her back into me. That was basically all you could see. Then there was cameras going up, so you could see me going up the stairs, talking to the bouncers. There's a policewoman there outside, which I shook hands with them, and she was just there talking to the bouncers. And that was all. And that was all it was that they sort of had me. They said, okay, these samples of the her pants had been taken away. And like, this is a month later. They arrested me a month later, so you would have thought, okay, we've taken them away straight after the alleged incident. Surely you would have something back by now. But and then you weren't allowed to talk about it. And this was the biggest, I suppose, well, I had to be that resilient, thick skin, because one, I was going through marriage separation with the ex. My son was back here. She was playing real, not really amicable and stuff. And so there was all that crap going on. I was stuck in a hotel trying to sort of say, trying to explain what was kind of happening. But then you weren't allowed to talk about it. To then come back and go, far out. And the problem you have, the justice system, right up until, you're actually told to go back, you can't, there's no saying it. Then you go back and they try to put it in the magistrate court, which is basically a courtware system where you come in, you're in front of a judge that's there for the day. So I came back to New Zealand. I went back to Ireland, and then I had to wait around until the next date, which was effectively after the end of the season. So it would have been about another 4 or 5 months after, which I'd come back home to New Zealand. Then they were still looking through stuff, and then they wanted me to fly all the way back to plead guilty or not guilty in this magistrate court, which is basically people that have been done for drunk driving. They stand in front of a judge, and the judge basically says, he will slap you with a fine. So they wanted me to actually plead guilty. But there's massive ramifications.
Of course there is.
It's huge. Yeah. You're not just saying, and what they've got is kind of like, I don't understand why I'm actually here.
Also, you'd never plead guilty to something that you did not do.
Exactly. And that was a bit that hurt the most. And there was a lot of people around at the time there where they started scrambling to within that team environment, and that because they were out with me and they didn't want to get
implicated. Yeah.
Like almost to the fact they wrote letters based on China to be supportive, but all of the letters were was kind of being supportive for their own case, which really pissed me off.
I can imagine. But yeah, it's Lance Armstrong's got this saying. He talks about when shit hits the fan, people either lean in or lean out. And I talked about this with Matthew Ridge when he was on the podcast last year, and he goes, not many people lean in. Really find out who your mates
you
are.
You do, man. You do. So I ended up going back, and obviously there's no way. So they either say, well, you just mate, that's what's going to happen, or you go and you get in front of a but it's going to be a long process because you're going to have to be in front of a jury, and it could. But I knew I was innocent.
Yeah.
That's the whole bloody thing. There was no way, I was going to say I'm guilty for doing what? For nothing. Mm. I didn't actually do anything, And then
I can't imagine how frustrating this was.
Fuck, and you couldn't talk. Yeah. And so, but the biggest thing is the whole of New Zealand are looking at this. And when you hear sexual assault, it's so bad. It's like a... Mate, it's like you've been painted now as this guy that's
a sex offender. And I know there's the saying in legal circles, innocent or proven guilty, but it's not really.
Especially here.
Yeah.
You never are, and that's what I suppose we talk. We hardly really bring it up, but at the time you talk about it with Joe, and she's like, I don't know how you sort of stuck through it, but I knew.
It's Joe. She's your.
She's my wife. My wife. I knew that. Mate, there's no, I'm innocent. There's nothing in there for me, even though all this shit was going on in the background and seeing it. I stuck it out. I ended up signing for Italy. I'd already signed for Italy before this all happened, and they were really good, the Italians. They looked after me, told them what had sort of happened, and then they were really good, fantastic. And then until that day, we went into court where they basically threw the charges out. It was just kind of that whole process and what you had to go through, especially my son. My son was only like 7 or 4, but again, it's like, I often go back, and as much as I'm pissed off about the whole system and what sort of they got you into, to the things they had, to the people that they had, and at the end of the day, I made those choices too, to put yourself in a vulnerable position.
But what do you mean though? What choices did you make?
Oh, I think...
Like, just not just being out.
Yeah, I think because part of me has always sort of wanted to phase myself out and be sort of anonymous, you almost get to a stage where you're like, you're thinking you are anonymous out there because of your mindset, whereas, in fact, you never are. You absolutely never are, regardless of whether, you're whether you're a professional rugby player or not. Things you do will always become I'd almost already jumped into that mold, so when you jump into that mold, you've got to have that in the back of your mind that when you do go out, that you are a target. And these things that come in, no matter whether you like it or not, that's just the case. But again, it's just I just can't believe that you go through that. Like, I've gone through a lot of adversity in my life, a lot of stuff. Some of them brought on by myself, others that should never have damn happened. But you've got to be pretty thick-skinned. But that's probably made me who I am today, like a little confident, like you say, in terms of what I've done. But I also understand too, I've got 3 boys now. I understand the consequences that come with a lot of my decisions. Mm-hmm. And also... enjoying
in terms of the ripple effect onto
absolutely. And the boys will never know that, but the thing is, the internet's always there too, so then my boys will be living in a life of internet and googling a name and things coming up, and so we're always mindful that we've got to be upfront and honest with the boys, because it's just this day and age is a lot different to when the days that I was growing up and got old in the cargo with the wide roads.
how did you navigate your way through that period, like waiting for the trial? Were you crying a lot? Were you just angry?
I didn't cry. Nothing to cry about. I am an emotional person. Yeah. There's nothing to cry about. I was more determined that, fuck, this is going to be all right. Yeah. I knew 100% that this was going to be okay. you know, I had a lot of support, good support back home in New Zealand with, you know, my mates down, Chiefs manager, with the old Chiefs manager, sorry, we're really good friends. If Joe was really there, even though she was, I think it was good being away from New Zealand. I'd hate to think what my son was going through.
Because how old was he at the time?
What was it, 2014, so
9 years ago.
9 years ago. So he would have been four or five, six actually, yeah. So, like,
well, probably, he's probably young enough to not be too impacted by it.
Yeah, not, yeah, exactly, wow. But still. So I think help being in Italy, and Italian is wonderful. It's a wonderful place. You are basically anonymous because no one really knows rugby there. So that definitely helped. But I think the frustrating part is that I knew the day would come. It was just when, you know, when would I be able to tell my story? And I haven't really spoken about it. I've only spoken about it once until today. I haven't really touched on what I seen in that video and some of the things that I did see that perhaps I might want to bring out one day. That's the real annoying part for me, that, you know, when you say people lean in and lean out, you know, the people that leant out had reasons as to why, which is, it fucked me off at the time. But I've, you know, I've got a long memory and I'm always one to really forgive. But
you never forget, though, right?
No, never. And that's what really annoyed me at the time too, you know, whilst all this was going on. But that's part of life, you know. It is. It's part of understanding people and sort of working your way through that and being hardened about it. Don, it's kind of, and I've always had that. I don't know what it is, because I've, perhaps it's from my upbringing and being always that little boy that used to tag along with my older brother, and he used to always sort of leave me behind, and I was always resilient in terms of that, sort of beat me up every now and then to sort of stop me from going. Yeah. But it's always been in me. So,
But you don't want to be you don't want to be too hardened, eh? You don't want to become cynical. You don't want to become that person. But mate, I don't know how you navigated your way through that period. Did you see a therapist or have any counselling or anything?
No, I didn't. I didn't.
Oh man,
I didn't really. I didn't even really know if I really talked too much about it. I think Joe and I were over there and just sort of, I navigated my way through there. I think a lot of me knew what had happened. A lot of me knew that it was going to be all right, even though at the time when you're sitting in there, you think, fuck, I don't even know how anyone could think like that. Do you know what I mean?
What do you say in the CCTV thing, you pushed here? What do you mean you pushed here? Like just an excuse me.
So there's a pillar there, and she's basically turned around and walked into me and bumped me into another person, and I've kind of like, I wouldn't have even thought it was a tap. It wasn't really a push. And then she's turned around and we've kind of just said, well, it looks like it said things. But then I ended up getting kicked out. But this, we didn't get kicked out. Sorry, we walked out. Even in the statements and stuff. So you're trying to piece all this together because you're kind of like, well, here's some person saying this and another guy saying that, and we've walked out. There was no complaint to a police officer who was right upstairs. I mean, I'm not a conspiracy therapist, but at the time I was just kind of like, there's just nothing. And even when I was looking at it, you can vaguely even see me in the bar. When I first looked at it, they only showed me it twice. When I first looked at it, I was kind of like, I don't even know what I'm looking for or where I'm at. And that was basically it. I wouldn't even say it was even a push. That's the most disappointing part about it. It was just kind of like, it was just nothing, you know. But again, when I look at it, I think they've got themselves into that much now that it made
they had so to commit.
Much, well, they had to. It's like you had to go through with it. You know, there wasn't. But even the month before they even did all that, you know, you've got to be, surely you've got to know that you've got to have something. And it was like, I mean, the whole time it was almost like, it's funny because I look back and say, when I'm in the cell, and I'm sitting in there for the whole time that I was in there. That I it was almost like they try to exhaust the crap out of me to actually do something, which I was kind of like, this is so weird. But man, I had a lot of time to think about so much shit because I didn't know what was going on.
So you're trying to run through everything, even slightly bad.
I didn't even know what the heck I was doing there. You're having this thing with people yelling because it's a weekend, right? And so they're all yelling, they're all intoxicated, and they're like, fuck. And I'm sure it was just a bit of torture that they sort of sent me.
Yeah.
They gave me just to bloody say, mate, we're just going to torture you for a little bit. And then by 4 o'clock in the afternoon the next day, we might even try and see if we can get anything out of you.
Mm. Yeah, that must have been such a so you go to court. That must have been a nerve-wracking experience because you know unequivocally that you've done nothing wrong, but there must be like a little bit in you that thinks, well, you know, maybe, you know, stranger things have happened. No,
it's a funny thing because like there's two phases to the court stuff. So you have that and you plead not guilty, then there's another court date. Okay, you come up and you're in front of them, so you're going through that whole period. Then there's another court date where you're basically saying you're not guilty again to them for them to work out, you know how the jury stuff's going to work or what happens. So that second time we went in there, by the time we sort of got there, they were like, nah, everything's going to be dropped. And you're kind of, well, we've just wasted all that time. So I was going in there going, okay, we're not doing it today. There's going to be another time where it's all going to happen. And that's when the public will understand and know, and people will know that I haven't done anything, you know. And so because it was cut short, it was probably, you know, unexpected. And they didn't tell me until we're about to sort of literally go in. We were like, hey, these guys want to, we want to have a chat. The lawyer wanted, they'd spoken to the lawyer, the police and that, and it was basically done. So within the I didn't know what to think because at the time I was just kind of thinking, far out, this is crazy because I'm about to go in there and all this that I've gone through has been for nothing because I wanted people to see things.
Mm.
I wanted them to see that and see exactly what it was.
Yeah, you want to shout
it
from the rooftops.
Well, not even this CCTV. I'm like, man, I want people to see that. I want people to see and understand that, you know, that her pants got taken away straight after to be tested for fingerprints. And it's kind of like, it's the most stupidest thing that you could ever, you know, think about. But surely at that time, when you're taking someone off a rugby pitch, driving them 2 or 3 hours to bloody Cardiff, chucking them in a cell, that you're going to, it's guilty all day. Do you know what I mean?
And the optics are bad.
Yeah, I mean,
it's not good.
Nah.
You think so, Mills must have done something really, really bad.
Yeah, exactly. And that was the way, unfortunately, it was portrayed because as soon as you use the language sexual assault, it's like, fuck, you do rape.
Mm.
At the time, there's still a bit of anger. You think, fucking hell, why can't she be named? But
yeah.
You don't want that either. At the same time, you go, oh, fuck, mate. I mean, whatever reasoning they have or whatever. I mean, that part of me wanted that trial to happen for that reason.
Yeah.
To actually name the person too. Because I knew 100% that I hadn't done anything.
Mm.
And so I suppose the next goal was, I can't wait for this to happen. It's not something that you can't wait for, but I always knew the day would come.
Yeah.
And it came a lot earlier, even though it wasn't that, it took still ages to get to earlier than what I was anticipating.
Well, it's a lot to go through. It is, hey, it's a lot. Life for the most part is pretty flat and boring. And then in between there's some real, real highs and real, real lows for everyone. Your highs have been very, very high. Your lows have been very low as well.
They're crazy, yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, the ones in your early 20s, like they were, yeah, that's your, you know, you own that, you wear that, that's your fault. But this one, what a thing to go through.
Yeah, and I think, man, it's not something you dwell on. Like,
how do you not?
Where does
that come from?
I'm not a big believer in holding on to stuff. Mm. You know, I know, you never forget. You don't, but fuck, holding a grudge on so much shit is just, it's not healthy.
Mm.
It's not really, I get excited by the things ahead. You know, my life's man, my life's way better than what it was during that period of time. I've learnt a lot from that, you know. I've got a wonderful family. Just things like that, you can just, you know, there's no use holding on to shit. I mean, don't get me wrong, every now and then they're angry, but yeah, just wasted energy sort of holding on to that stuff, eh?
Yeah. Oh, 100%. And how was your, she was your girlfriend at the time, eh? Mm. How was she through this whole period?
Yeah, she was good.
Yeah.
Well, I think so. I think she struggled the most because there is a bit in there where, and you can understandably, it's understandable that there would have been doubts in her mind about sort of what happened.
Yeah, and I suppose she's got her friends and her sort of family.
But it was, you know, she understands. I mean, there's still that side of me who's bubbly and stuff and likes a bit of to layer up every now and then. But Joe has been awesome in terms of I you know, her support during that time was probably a lot of that probably got me through. She's very similar to my mother. But yeah, I haven't spoken about this because it's just not. Oh, it's not something you sort of dwell back on.
No. Well, thanks for talking about it today. I mean, I wasn't sure if you wanted to or not. And either way, that's cool.
Yeah.
I suppose because it's reasonably recent, it feels like if this was the Mills book, it probably feels like a chapter or a couple of chapters. But
I'd love to write another book. I sit back and I wrote the one that I wrote too early. I think I'm definitely a different person. I've definitely got a different sort of perspective of life and stuff too.
It's funny that, eh? How much you change. I've had Adam Perori on the podcast, and he's 52 now, and he says he doesn't recognise the cocky, brash wicketkeeper that he was in his early 20s. And it's like, but that was his authentic self at the time. But you just change and you grow. And then I think if you get to middle age and you're embarrassed about some of the stuff you've done, it's probably good.
Yeah, it's not a bad thing, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, I mean, the alternative is not changing at all. And
that's
no good.
That's it.
We'll close that chapter. I appreciate you being so honest and open about it, because I can tell it's not an easy thing to talk about. So thanks for talking about it on my podcast today. You're good?
I'm good. I'm good. Yeah, it's actually quite
cathartic.
Yeah, it is. Like, you're kind of like, because I wouldn't say I'm apprehensive about bringing it up, but it's also important that it is part of my life too. That you're kind of like thinking far out. It's recognizing, acknowledging how the frigging heck I went through that. I don't even like just. You talking about it and sort of seeing it today, I was like, mate, I'll let you read through that shit. And,
you made it through the other end.
Yeah, and it makes things way better now. It's just sort of is a good way to celebrate sort of the success I've had off the field too, having gone through that nonsense.
How has it changed you? Like, do you avoid going out now? Or, I mean, you shouldn't, because, you know, you didn't do anything wrong. But.
Yeah, I mean... I still like going out. I don't go out as much as what I used to. Kids sort of have had that effect on us. But
if you're 43 and you're rolling at a spy bar at 2 in the morning.
Imagine that. Far out. It's not good the next day either. So,
nah.
But it's maturity, isn't it? It's just growing up and then understanding that, you know, a good time, it's about planning your good times, like, you know, and having – sort of things in place. I've got a really good group of friends that understand, you know, who I am and what I do, that we're not sort of going out to get mothered anymore or putting yourself in a vulnerable position where I think a lot of my friends in the car would do that just for the sheer laughter of it all. And it's not funny because the consequence for me is way bigger.
Yeah, it is. You've got a massive, I mean, as we said, you're one of like 9 people that have played 100 tests. So the target on your back for the rest of your life is massive.
Yeah. So, yes, I've just got an understanding of that. I mean, and to be honest, I appreciate having a few at home and just going to the batch and doing the same thing every 3 or 4 years or whatever that is. I'm actually going to the State of Origin, which I can't wait for. But even my mates talk about that. Hey, we just got to make sure we don't get too carried away. It's just, we would never have those conversations before. Do you know what I mean? So it's just be mindful of you, right? But there's never, no way you'd go back to the stuff that I used to do.
No. And who's your close group of mates? Are they any of them, anyone that we'd know?
No, the majority of my schoolmates from Kelston Boys. We've got a really good group. All my mates there. It's just funny. Everyone always asks you, you know, who's your mates from the All Blacks? Who, like, you know, who do you get on with the most? You love them, mate. It's like your best mates when you're there. And when you leave the environment, you go back to your own families and friends. But when you come back, it's like you've never left. Mm. But they're not your mates. They're not your...
Yeah, they're your workmates.
They're your workmates. Yeah, right. Yeah. And so, but I've got a real, man, since, you know, when I came up to Kelston, all my group of friends are still around, and we have our group chats, and we should really catch up more, but we always say we do, but we never do. But we keep in contact, which is fantastic. Mm. Yeah.
So how many World Cups did you win? Just the one?
Just the one.
2011, yeah. Yep. Fuck, how good was that?
Mate.
Oh, my God. So that was the game against France. What was it, 8-7 in the final? Yeah. Shit.
Yeah.
Oh, crazy. That was the worst game to watch ever. That was just
I was injured as well, so I was watching it beside Dan, and it's got to be the most nerve-wracking moment of our lives. Even with Beaver, we jumped up and slotted that over too. It's just kind of like, fuck, please don't let this happen again to us, because that would have been our third time.
That's right. That, the whole thing is absurd, eh? So, Dan got injured early on. Richie had a broken foot and was like barely training during the week, and training in like running shoes. Yeah. And Aaron Cruden got called up, and then Stephen Donald.
Yeah, and then all the stuff that had happened with Corey Jane and Izzy going out and stuff, and that, I mean...
Oh, that's right, smoking some durries and having sleeping pills
it's
and Red Bull.
It's a soap opera, isn't it? Yeah. It was like, it needed a good ending, and the good ending was that we won when we shouldn't have, because France played way better than what we did. But that stuff in 2007 was what got us home, and, man, we had some good couple of days of celebrations after that.
So what was it? 2007, was that the one that we talked about earlier?
Quarterfinal. 2003 we lost the semi-final to Australia. 2007 we lost the quarters to France, and 2011 we won.
It's like we talked about earlier, like you learn much more from your failures, don't they?
Yeah.
That the one in 2007 against France, I remember, you know, the shots of Ted, Graham Henry and Richie at the press conference afterwards, and Richie just looks, you know, like numb. He does a thing where he rubs his face, and everyone thought he was sort of crying, and he wasn't, but he, you know, you could tell he was distressed or unhappy.
That's one of the days you do want to forget, but man, it still hurts. 2007. It was because for a lot of us, we're at our time in our career where we were going to be finishing up, and then obviously if we'd won that, it would have been a perfect way to go overseas and make some money, cash in on it. But then you're kind of getting to the age of 27. Next one's like 31. You're like, shit, I don't know if I'll make it. That's definitely what I fell into. I was like, oh, far out. So it was way more satisfying to win that because of what we'd gone through in 2007, more so than 2003, because we're so young. Mm. We're probably a little bit naive in terms of the whole World Cup stuff for a lot of us that came through from 2003. So 11 was fantastic, man. It's so cool.
And you've got such a good life, and there's you're thriving with the business, and there's so much to look forward to. Do you spend much time like reflecting or looking back? Are you much of a sentimentalist like that?
I am not. I'm not a sentimentalist. Even my jerseys there, I couldn't care less where I live.
Really? So, where are they? Are they in a box in a garage?
They're downstairs. And
how many of them did you give away? Or how many of you still?
I couldn't tell you. Really. I had to buy them back off my ex-wife, actually, as part of the separation.
Oh, really?
It cost me like $100,000, eh? But I only did it.
Oh, my God. Really?
I only did it because...
Who priced them?
Well, fuck, she went and got them that he valued at somewhere overseas. But I didn't even actually, I didn't even care. I was kind of like, sweet, let's sell them. But it wasn't until when they itemised it, because I didn't have them, that he talked to my kids and my son, who I had with her, and said, like, Dad, can I have one of your jerseys? And you're like, oh, shit. Okay, how am I going to keep these even if I'm going to sell them? And that was the only reason. Joe was like, you've got to buy them. So, I mean, fucking the scheme of things, it is for the boys. And my medal's somewhere.
The Commonwealth Games, is that a gold?
I've got a Commonwealth Games gold medal, which is the boys and my cap. that they put on every now and then. It's probably lost somewhere under their beds or something.
For your 100 tests.
For my 100 tests.
Mills.
I know. It's but
come on, pull your head up.
I've got to come on. I'm not big on that.
Donate them to a museum or something.
Yeah, I should really. I should. I mean, I've given them some away since I finished when they asked them for charity in that. They literally are in a suitcase, like collecting dust, because I'm not big on celebrating. I don't even have a jersey up in my house. Mum's, which I'm more embarrassed about, she puts one up at her place, and I'm like, man, you got to get that down. It's just not something, like, memories for me is more important than that. Like, I don't need this sentimental thing to say, I'm praying, and this is what I did. But my kids now, they love it. You know, they love the fact that they still can't believe I was an All Black.
Not just an All Black, like a great All Black.
Oh, yeah. I don't know, mate.
How many tries did you score? Where are you on the try list?
Mate, I'm way behind, so I wouldn't even have a clue how many tries I sort of scored. My kids keep asking me that. I should really do a Google search on it.
By the way, can I just say you're a hopeless guest when it comes to talking about the rugby stuff?
Man, honestly, I'm not sentimental on any of that stuff. It's just,
Is it a modesty thing or what is it? Where do you think this comes from?
Mate, my memories are up here and probably in here more than anything else. Like,
shit memories. Stuff. You can't even remember how many tries you scored.
Yeah, they are shit, eh? I think it's once you've sort of done it, you're kind of. It's probably more also related to when I said, you know, I want to become anonymous. That's probably part of it too. Yeah. I don't need to hold on to stuff to say, man, that's me, that's my identity. Because being an All Black isn't. Like, you as a person and going through what you've done and what you're doing now and inspiring other people, that's more me. You know, I love helping people, which is why I'm in this sort of space, particularly in the Māori and Pacific Island space. So we help a lot in that, and we've had massive success in terms of home ownership for Pacific Islanders, which is I'm really proud of. I don't need, even though it's probably, you know, getting in front of these families have come from being an All Black, but I don't need to dangle it and say, hey, this is who I am, I'm an All Black. You know, you need to, but I don't know. I've just never had that before. My probably the one jersey that I probably do hold on to that I've folded and left in my wardrobe is a New Zealand Schools jersey that I actually gave away to the Solomons, which they gifted back to me on my 40th. It's funny because I wrote on the back of it the score, the massive jerseys, and that's probably the only ones that I've got. There's an under-19 ones that they gave back to, and that's probably more special to me because that's where my journey started.
Yeah.
From all of that. So I would say, and literally, I mean, it's not hung up or anything, but it's folded, sitting underneath my baseball caps, I think. So
part of me shakes my head in disbelief that you've got these amazing things and, you know, you couldn't care less about them. But then part of me, I'm fucking proud of you because it means, you know, if you weren't doing anything worthwhile with your life now, it'd be very easy just to, like, sit in the past or look in the past. But the fact that you're doing good stuff and you're thriving in this next phase of your life, and, like, people say life's short, but it's actually bloody long. You're like, you've still got another career or a couple of careers ahead of you. I think it's kind of cool.
Yeah, I love it. I love what I'm doing. I'm busy, probably too busy now. And it's so crazy because I'm now going to the Rugby World Cup, the fourth one, as a commentator, and I never in my wildest dreams would I have ever thought, shit, I'm actually commentating. I commentate and actually say stuff in the weekends and in shows, and now I'm going to the pinnacle of rugby, and I'm actually calling a game, and to be selected to do that and be trusted to do that is it's hard because I know I have to leave my family behind.
How old are your younger kids now?
So Max is 14, Mackenzie, he's 5, and Marco's 4.
Right.
So I'm not a big traveller.
Yeah.
And Sky have been awesome for me. They've been like, in terms of even domestically. So, but to have them sort of back me to go over to the World Cup for 9 weeks, I know we'll get there. It's going to be massive. So I'm really looking forward to that. So I've got a really good balance in life. I've got a nice job Monday to well, it's not really a job because it's your own company.
Yes.
Then I get to the Fridays and you're starting to prep for the weekend, and then you go through there. The hardest part is when the All Blacks don't go so well, because you have to talk about it.
Last year's been a rough one. How do you find that? So when you were a player, if a commentator or a writer or JK, say for example, wrote something mean about you, were you did you get salty about it?
You know, eh? Because you know, and I've always said that, man. I'm when I'm finished, I'm never gonna be that old All Black guy that's gonna bag the guys. Just far, you know. I hope it comes. Like, I know I'm mindful of the words you use. You got to have an opinion, and I think the more that I've sat in this role, the more I've been comfortable with having an opinion. Because at the same time, you're sort of still certain. Man, I don't want to say that about them, or I don't have the right to say that. But there's ways of doing it and being respectable about it.
Yeah.
And then hopefully it doesn't get taken out of context, because a lot of it does. It makes good...
clickbait.
It does, big time. And unfortunately, that's just the world we kind of live in. But I've always been... but you also... You don't want to lie about the way they're going either, you know, because as a former player too, you know when you're playing shit. You know that you haven't found form, but you believe the fact that it's going to come. So I often kind of put myself in their shoes in terms of what, man, how would I feel? How would I be feeling right now? And why are these challenges sort of happening? Why isn't, you know? So I am very mindful of that. But at the same time, I think I've gotten really comfortable. The guys at Sky have been awesome and comfortable in what I yeah. my opinion, and that I actually have one.
I feel like New Zealand's in general, a kinder place now. Like you talked about being nervous about coming back from the 2007, World Cup?
Yeah.
I feel like New Zealand's a more tolerant place now.
Right?
Like the backlash, like, you're not going to get people spitting on you like they did it to Coach John Hart back in the day.
Nah, but it helps that you've won a couple of World Cups too. So once we've done it now, we only won one.
Yeah.
But
you know, it's like, oh, well, we can't win it every time.
Yeah. I think, they're more receptive of that. You know, Kiwis... It's tough. They've always been chasing us, but we're more realistic now in terms of our, you know, hey, we can't win them all, and you can't, you absolutely can't. Yeah. There was the day where we did, and we were very successful. I mean, that got boring too, right?
Yeah.
When we had 93% sort of win record, so
which is crazy.
I know, and that's massive in terms of sport in general, right? And so I think, you know, Kiwis have, and there's other things too that are around. We're so successful with so many other sports, and even individual sports is awesome.
Yeah. And how's your relationship with the ex now? Is there any sort of relationship now?
Nah, that's all right, mate. It's just
because you're the oldest boy together.
Yes. Yeah.
So you're co-parenting okay?
I think it's good.
These things take time, eh?
Oh, mate, it's not a part of, like, we don't talk, so I think for Max's sake, we've sort of just gotten on with it. And we've got the process that's in place is pretty good. I am still mindful of the fact of Max is a big part of our lives.
Yeah.
So we give him 50-50. But he's becoming that teenage boy too that I was, and I often put myself in the, man, where is he at with this? And being mindful of my role in this, even though I don't get on with his mother.
You're both respectful of each other. Like, you're not bad mouthing each other.
No, I can't control what she does. Yeah. But I think, mate, it took a long time. Mm. I mean, you talk about the court process that we just spoken about.
Yeah.
It took me a long time to get to where this, you know, Max was. So perhaps part of that for me hardened me in terms of the stuff that I was going through. Mm. Because even that part of getting access to Max was very difficult in the justice system.
Oh, God, the messiness of being an adult, hey?
Oh, mate.
Life is tough.
I talk about experience, right? And so COVID brought us, not that you really want, business, you know, through breakups. Mm. And when you're talking to clients about your own experiences and buying back your 100 old jerseys, whatever it is, for 100K or whatever it was, they laugh, right? They laugh about that.
It's a hell of a yarn.
Yeah, and so you, that's the experience I'm talking about. Yeah. Going through, you can't beat going through the stuff ups. I mean, I hope
awful at the time though.
Yeah, absolutely. But you've got to use that in some way, and that's how I use my experience. Man, there's and
what's the lesson in this?
What is it? I mean, the lesson in is think about the kids.
Yeah.
You know, you're going to get to the end result, but what does that cost you in terms of not just monetary, but the mental burden on your own kids? Yeah. Like, I'm not there to be a psychologist, but I'm there to share my frustrations that I did, that I probably would have done things a little bit different too, and sort of be supportive around some of the things that they need to. Admittedly, you're just there to give them their financial advice in terms of where they can get to and what they're looking to try and do, whether it's buy out or you know, sell everything up and then buy. But I think there's also an element too where you're sort of, because you've gone through it yourself, that you can appreciate some of the things that you're actually talking about. I mean, you're selling all your portfolio and giving half away and you're thinking, okay, you're never gonna get back to what it is, and there's no way. I mean, you built that all up. I've started again, and it's way more satisfying this time because I know a lot more than what I did. Admittedly, I wouldn't have loved to give away a 2,000 square metre property out in New Lynn that I could have sold to a developer for 50 to 100 million. But, hey, what do you do? You mean, you can't just dwell on that sort of stuff. So experience is big. It's huge in terms of the space that I'm in, both on, you know, on the rugby pitch and also – you know, the financial stuff that I'm doing.
Yeah. Well, I can't wait to see what your next mistake is.
hopefully not more.
Mistakes, as long as you learn from them, I think they're fine. But I say I can't, I kind of mean that in a way, like your next mistake, yeah. It's not going to be something alcohol related, because I feel like you've completely learned every lesson there is to be learned there. Yeah, so I suppose good and bad, I can't wait to see what's next in the Mills story.
Yeah, I mean,
what a life.
I know, it has. I mean, this is probably the most I've ever reflected back on anything I've done. So I thank you, Dom, for inviting me into this space and talk about myself, because it's not something I've ever done before.
I can tell. It's a shame in a way, because you've got so many stories to tell, and if the time comes where you change your mind and you want to be a bit more public, I know there's you do very well on the public speaking circuit. You got a lot of lessons, and a lot of people can learn a lot of stuff from you.
Yeah. Not quite the need.
Actually, lessons and just fucking good memories too.
Yeah, and I think that's the thing. Like, fuck, you forget some of those memories because you don't go back and reflect on it. Man, there's so many of the really good stuff that you just kind of think, because you've parked that side of your life away and you're kind of I'm done with that life, you know, it's all sweet as. But when you remember, you're like, oh, actually, yeah, that's right, and that's what happened, that's what happened, even the stuff that I've spoken to you about, there's so much funny shit that happened during that time that probably made things a lot easier too. It probably didn't seem like it at the time.
Yeah, well, when something like that's going on, I suppose it's like all consuming. So
yeah.
But anyway, my friend Dougie, who's filming this, he just brought in a note saying 34 tries.
34
tries, which puts you in the top 30 in world rugby.
Oh, really? Yeah. Oh, I didn't know that. Oh, mate, that's
awesome. Dougie, is it world rugby or just All Blacks?
Rugby Union, in the top 30.
Not bad.
I should have been more greedy, yeah.
Too giving. All right, hey, Millers Millionaire, thank you so much, man. I've really, really enjoyed it. It's been awesome. And thanks for being so open and so vulnerable.
Thanks for having me, Dom. Pleasure.
Millers Millionaire on Runners Only with Dom Harvey. Thank you very much for making it all the way through. Hey, quick one, if you haven't done so already. On the app where you listen to this podcast, for most people it's either Apple or Spotify, could you subscribe to the podcast? Most people don't, as in a majority of people don't. They just listen to the episodes. But if you subscribe or leave a review, if the platform allows, or give it a star rating, 5 preferably, that does go a long way. Thanks in advance for doing that. Just before we end, thanks again to the sponsors of this episode of Runners Only with Dom Harvey, Radix Nutrition and Skin Institute. From their factory in the Waikato, Radix Nutrition are making world-class nutritional products. If you currently have a daily protein shake, you should definitely try the Radix stuff. It is, in my opinion, the best. And they have just introduced 2 epic new flavors to their range, mango and blueberry. Check them out online, radixnutrition.co.nz. That's Radix, R-A-D-I-X. Also, thanks to my friends at Skin Institute. 6,000 Kiwis are diagnosed with melanoma every year, and 300 of us will die from it. Early detection is imperative to avoid becoming a statistic. Skin Institute are the skin cancer experts. Go and see them for a full body skin check. Their website, skininstitute.co.nz, or call them on 0800 754 637. 0800 754 637. As a word number, that's 0800 Skin Doctor, DR. All right, once again, thanks. I appreciate you listening. I appreciate you being here. I appreciate all your comments and feedback. And I do hope to see you next week on Runners Only with Dom Harvey.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Bowl and Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Bowl and Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bowlandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.